Into the Fold is part of the Texas Podcast Network, the conversations changing the world. Brought to you by the University of Texas at Austin, the opinions expressed in this podcast represent the views of the hosts and guests and not of the University of Texas at Austin.
What I saw was the resiliency of the human spirit, where in the midst of getting caught up in systems that tended to put them in places they didn't want to be sometimes, and who relegated them to a class of citizenship that was not accepted by the whole. And, you know, I thought if they could still hold on to hopes and dreams and still fight for having a life, who was I to say that I didn't want to be alive anymore?
Hi, welcome to Into the Fold, the mental health podcast. I'm your host, Ike Evans, and today we're delighted to bring you episode 121, Peer Leadership and Why It Matters. Nothing about us without us. It's the famous mantra of the disability rights movement, and then adopted by the mental health consumer movement. This movement, which we will be talking about today, has numerous achievements to show for its work, both in Texas and nationally, thanks to decades of effort by advocates both inside and outside of the mainstream. Mental health consumers have assumed their rightful place in positions of leadership. It wasn't always so. Historically, the mental health system and the conversation surrounding it has given more value to the expert opinions of providers and clinicians than the experiences of those living with mental health conditions. Here's our own Tammy Hines speaking to that history from episode 77, Consumer Voice, Its Role in Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion.
I think that using the term lived experience, particularly around mental health issues, really brings an honor to the experiences, the life experiences that we've all had. And I think that for so long, people like us were stigmatized and it was seen as only a negative. And therefore, we were consumers of the mental health system. We were survivors of the mental health system. We were patients of a hospital. It's always being of something or some other entity. This allows us to kind of own our own selves again. We get to say this is our experience, and our experience contributes to the totality of who we are. And part of what creates who I am is my lived experience of mental health, my lived experience of recovery, my lived experience of having mental health issues, and bringing all that into one space.
Today, elevating the visibility of mental health consumers is now commonplace for mental health organizations, institutions, and leaders who recognize the many advantages of giving mental health consumers more autonomy and authority in the mental health space. But what else needs to happen before we're able to truly say that mental health consumers have arrived? And in the context of a mammoth state agency like the Texas Department of Health and Human Services, what does nothing about us without us look like? To help answer that question, I've invited two mental health consumers. First, our good friend Noah Abdenor, Director of Peer and Recovery Services Programs, Planning, and Policy for Texas HHS, and then Anna Gray, Director of Prosumers International, a peer-run organization. Before we begin, a note on definitions. Throughout, I'll be using the term consumers as a shorthand for those who have experienced mental health conditions and received mental health services. Peer will sometimes be used to refer to those consumers who use their lived experience to give extra weight to their advocacy or as key to their professional identity. Peer support specialists, for example. So, without further ado, Noah, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
So, our listeners would love to know a little bit more about you. And in particular, how did your past experience prepare you for your current role at HHSC?
Well, that is a wonderful question. I started in this field right about 10 years ago. So I'm a certified mental health peer specialist, which means, you know, I have all the lived experience with the mental health challenge and things not going well. And so for me, that was about a decade in my 20s. A lot of that had to do with isolation, substance use, and things being pretty bleak. And so when I got my life to that place where things were coming back together, I started looking for somewhere to have a job and begin to get my life back on track. My family had run restaurants growing up, so I never really thought of any other option than working in the food industry. In the meantime, I thought I'd volunteer, at somewhere where I could interact with folks that were struggling like I had been struggling. And so for me, that meant looking at hospitals, you know, psychiatric hospitals, because I had been inpatient a couple of times. But in the volunteer interview, the volunteer coordinator told me about this thing called peer support that I had never heard of. And so, you know, I came into this program that at that time there was, I think, about, you know, 8 to 10 peer specialists. It was a new fledgling program that had just been going on a couple of years, and got to really be involved in something from the ground floor. And I think the thing that's really helped me prepare for this role is, you know, being a part of something that's new, where like a lot of the roles that I've been in, whether that was, you know, being the director of the peer services program at ASH when I was hired on and then moved into a leadership position. I was a lot of times the first person to sit on different committees or to do different things, you know, being a part of the legislative push or a part of the Hogg Policy Academy was, you know, kind of the first peer support program that was really involved with that initiative that you all do at the Hogg Foundation, with policy fellows. Or when I switched over and was, you know, working at Bluebonnet Trails, like a lot of the positions I've been in, I've been the first peer specialist in them. You know, I think I've been blessed to be on the shoulders of the people in front of me that have, you know, been the pioneers of this work. But I see the work that I've been doing is really taking those kind of pioneering steps and how do we take that to the next level and really codify that into our system. So I think I have comfort, you know, really being given something and not having many instructions on how to do it, you know. And I think that's a big part of doing peer support work is coming with curiosity and kind of looking at things with fresh eyes, you know. Coming into this role at HHSC, being the first director of this program, I think I have comfort with not quite having a roadmap on how to do it. And that's been really helpful.
So you are Director of Peer and Recovery Services. Describe the position and what kind of impact that you're hoping to achieve.
So, our unit was created off of the legislation that passed in, I think it was around 2017 in the 85th legislative session. It was House Bill 1486, which created the Peer Services Medicaid benefit. And so, I was a person that was selected to be the presiding officer of the work group that worked with the agency to define the scope of work or the scope of practice for peer specialists, define supervision, what certification was going to look like, et cetera. So through that process, HHS really determined that they needed to have an office or a unit of peer support that was dedicated to the implementation of that benefit and then to grow peer services across the state. Because I think one of the intentions of the legislator that that sponsored it, Chairman Ford Price, was to help, you know, alleviate the workforce shortage and have peer specialists be a new integral part of our behavioral health workforce. So, you know, they thought having somebody that was a peer specialist lead that effort and the team to develop that would be the best way to move forward. And that was things that they had heard from stakeholders and also other states that they'd reached out to. So, you know, we were given the charge coming in and being the director of that program. The first charge was to implement that benefit, you know, and so that was, that meant aligning old processes, old certification entities. We had to really, you know, grandfather folks into this new benefit, make sure that they were credentialed with the new codified, you know, Medicaid credential, and then come up with a strategy on how we were going to develop peer support, you know, moving forward. So a lot of that comes from my own experience leading programs in the field, kind of having successes. And then it's also like deeply informed by the mistakes or the challenges that I faced trying to build these programs in the community. And then we sent out, you know, one of the first things that we did is we had a national peer support expert go out and do focus groups with our community. Because I think, you know, the other thing is we want to institute and build a program here at the state that replicates that you know, the peer support ethics and values in a new place and on a new level. And so, you know, that means that we're led by our stakeholders, that those that are having, in this case, the lived experience is going to be with delivering these services in the field. They're going to be the ones that best know how to proceed and move forward. And we really need to stay connected to those folks in the field so they can let us know what we can do to help support them, remove barriers, provide resources, et cetera. So in these different ways, I think that the resounding thing that we heard back from folks is that we really need to invest as a state in building our peer and recovery organization. So that's gonna be our peer-run organizations, like consumer-operated service providers, like recovery community organizations. And so that's the mental health and substance use peer-run organizations. You know, invest in our mental health clubhouses, and then invest in the programs inside of our clinical organizations that are really devoted to developing these. But we really see the answer to some of the questions that folks have, like, how do we create more of a career ladder? How do we create more accessible services across the state? We see investing in these community-based entities, especially our peer organizations, as being the answer to that. So what we're hoping to achieve now is to begin to operationalize that vision. Like, how do we build this network of community-based peer and recovery organizations that are providing these non-clinical services that are a place for people in recovery, like I was when I was seeking out recovery. You know, I walked into a support group and I found recovery completely on accident. Like, there was a Depression Bipolar Support Alliance group that I ended up finding, you know, just by searching the web and the people in that group, seeing other people that were seeking out recovery in their lives and being able to just talk about the things that they were doing and seeing them trying to better their lives completely changed my perspective on, you know, what kind of control I had over my own situation. I think I was waiting for the pill or the therapy that was going to fix everything and didn't realize that really it was up to me to do all these things. And, you know, feeling that empowerment to take the reins or take the driving, you know, the steering wheel, whatever metaphor you want to use, was something that I needed to see somebody else doing it before I could do it. But I want people to encounter recovery on purpose. And you know, I think that's the big change we want to make in the state, is move from having pockets, pilot programs, you know, a couple exemplary places that are providing these services, to making it something that everybody seeking services is able to encounter.
So you did mention some of the challenges that, you know, being the first to hold a position and not having much of a roadmap at the beginning, right? So what were in fact some of the biggest challenges that you confronted in the early going?
Well, in that, you know, it's such a double-edged sword, right? Like, having a blank canvas where you really get to build something from scratch that, you know, that can be an incredible, exciting opportunity. I think the other side of that is, you know, like the imposter syndrome feeling, like, I think I felt the weight of our entire community for a little bit there, like being the first person open with lived experience, that was the reason I was hired into the position. And that like peer support was a credential that I came into the agency under. You know, the first challenge is like the immensity of this bureaucracy. There's a lot to learn. You know, the HHSC is a massive, massive organization that moves at the speed of the state, which is a totally different pace, a totally different way of operating that, you know, I wasn't accustomed to. So the very first challenge was, you know, having the patience, having like sticking to a very, you know, methodical plan of moving kind of piece by piece and step by step, where you don't see those changes happening in the snap of a finger. So there was a very long period of time where I was pretty sure I was doing a really bad job, you know, when I wasn't seeing the things change as quickly as I had been accustomed to in providing services or in other organizations that were not as massive, you know, and weren't operating at the 10,000 foot level that you are when you're working at the state. So that was kind of the first challenge. I mean, the other is, you know, as a new unit, it's like every single thing that you're doing, whether that's writing a job description or, you know, to post and hire folks, or to like give feedback on legislation. Like a lot of what we do is we'll review legislation. You know, every single thing that we did for the first time, or that at first it was me that I did, it was building it from scratch. There was no templates that existed. So it was like really building it from the ground up. So every single thing that I did for the first time took a long time and a lot of effort. And that was daunting, you know? I think the other thing that you encounter are, you know, there's resistance to change. I think it's one of the most human things in the world. It's one of the things I think about recovery that like makes peer specialists and people that are very open about their lived experience, is that we've had to deal with change, or, you know, imposed change a lot of times where you don't really have control over that change. You know, that's something that we can become accustomed to kind of pivoting or silver lining and making the best of it. But when you have something like, you know, programs moving areas inside of a bureaucracy, like people have feelings about it, you know? And I think it has nothing to do with, you know, people supporting recovery. I think supportive recovery, supportive peer support has been absolute here. But people do have feelings when those programs that they have been kind of overseeing for a while move and the area that has control changes. So I think that was the other piece, is kind of dealing with that kind of very human reaction to change, and feeling that, as you know, somebody that's worked in the behavioral health field, you can tell when people aren't happy with stuff, you know. So those were a couple of the initial challenges, you know, and I think the hardest part was, you know, being alone, like being the only one on my team. So, you know, being able to hire, my first hire was Reggie Smith, who a former Hog Fellow, Hog Policy Fellow at Communities for Recovery.
Yeah. I mean, and a previous guest.
Yeah, he's a rock star, man. Like, I hope to do somewhere close to as well as he does with just about anything.
I have to agree.
Yeah, and then Wendy Latham was she's been the trailblazer up at the state for you know 15 years, or it's probably, I think, maybe 12 to 15, something like that. But she was immense help. And then, you know, different mentors and supporters that really helped in those first days.
So you did mention, like, at first being the only one. And so I'm just wondering if you have examples of ways that you tried to infuse your experiences as a peer into your work, And was there anything like a watershed moment for your colleagues that really kind of brought home for them, like, you know, wow, you know, this guy has something unique to contribute?
Well, you know, the thing that is profound to me, the way, like, first of all, is like the receptiveness and, like, I mean, coming into HHSC and the leadership and like the dynamic, like awesome people that I do work around still, but like in that first time, I think I was kind of like, you know, like doughy eyed, or, you know, it was kind of deer in the headlights, kind of like in awe of some of the people I was working with, because there are some brilliant, brilliant people that work here. It was really an intimidating thing. I think the place where I'm really good, like, I've kind of developed a strategy of how I do this work. I really try to first come in and try to be a little bit more quiet. I talk about wanting to build a foundation before shaking the house. You know, like, I think you need to build collegial relationships with the people you're working with first and foremost. And I think I did a lot of, in the beginning, a lot of the conversations that I had with my colleagues were private ones, you know, whether that was, you know, the director of mental health services at the time, or the community psychiatrist that was, you know, part of the hiring panel, that I immediately worked very closely with, like the head of our, you know, the clinical director's office. You know, I think at first, what I did was really built strong personal relationships with folks. And I think through trying to do that in a very like methodical way, like not trying to move too quickly, in asserting myself. I think I'm somebody that really likes the work of my unit, the work of my team to speak for itself. And then I, you know, that is really where I put a lot of the time and energy, was how do we build a really strong team, and start building that space. But I think through a lot of like kind of private conversations, you know, I think I have very collegial relationships with people. And I think that's kind of some of the first watershed type things, are that like we're all on equal footing, you know, that our area, whether that's myself as the director or anybody we hire, like if there isn't some different expectation for the work that we're doing, like we're gonna do the same type of work that everybody else does. But just trying to be steadfast and subtle with the advocacy, because I just think, you know, what I learned in moving from the hospital to the community was, you know, the way that we communicate in the hospital, which is a very, you know, you're almost triaging, right? Like things are moving very quickly. Passions are high. The stakes are high. You know, you have people that can be you know, the urgency of advocacy can be very high, and disagreements are, you know, can be passionate. And when I switched to the community, I had to tone down my advocacy, you know, I had to be more measured, more professional, I think, you know, more measured, more political. And then that switch from working in a community center to working in an office environment, I mean, I think that was much more drastic than I anticipated, that it's a much more subtle form of advocacy that you do, and a much longer tack that you take, you know. And so for me, those watershed moments, it really comes, it's taken years to see, you know, like how do you have influence over cycles of funding that go 5 years, you know? And so just this summer, we're seeing our first cycle of funding, you know, and that's around peer support training, around getting a partnership with the Hogg Foundation to bring folks in from North Carolina, from UNC, Greensboro, and from NC State to give mentorship and support to our peer-run organizations, or to run an accreditation pilot with a national organization, Faces and Voices of Recovery, so that we can show that our peer and recovery organizations are meeting a standard or in fidelity with national standards on the delivery of peer support services, or, you know, we have Peer Force, a new initiative that's happening in partnership with UTESCA's centralized training infrastructure and the San Antonio Clubhouse, where they're really acting as kind of a training coordination hub to the full state. They act kind of as peer support to the peer support community. And so to me, really the watershed thing is it, you know, what is it they say, like, you know, bring home the bacon, or like the proof is in the pudding. Like, I think the watershed moments are going to continue ahead. We need to bring more resources to the table for our community. And, you know, we're nudging ourselves in. We've created a seat at the table that didn't exist before. And what we've done is made sure our colleagues can see that we're level with all of them. And we're going to have a team of people that's going to continue to advocate for more recovery support, more recovery resources as we go forward, and give those resources to our community.
So do you have any personal stories that testify to the impact that you are having with this new role and this new function within HHSC, you know, that wouldn't have been possible otherwise?
Yeah, well, and I think, again, it's one of those things that there's a lot of little stories, you know. And I think, you know, when we get phone calls, I think there were people that were having some challenges around, you know, certifications and, you know, people calling us. I think we really, our unit sees that as our biggest responsibility, is to respond to and to support our community, you know. And I think sometimes the responses and the answers have to do with, you know, we vetted through the legal department and went through this big kind of state process. But when you see something like, you know, we've retiring legacy credentials, you know, moving from two certifications to one certification entity, you know, doing things that are going to help build our community as we go forward. You know, I think that's the proof of the work that we do kind of moves out in long tack things, you know. So I think when a peer specialist is able to see when they want to become certified as a peer specialist, they can call an entity, like pick up the phone and you can call essentially a 1-800 number or go to a website that shows all the training entities in the state of Texas that you can get have a scholarship. That it's funded by the state, that there's no cost to you for the person to become certified, to be connected to a supervisor if you need those supervised work hours. You know, those were all things that, like, you had to go through several different steps to figure out, you know. And I think something that we're going to try to do is really respond to the needs of our community and pivot when we need to pivot, you know. Use the kind of fail fast method. And I think that's something we'll continue to bring to the table, is like, we're not going to think that we know best. That's just not what this work is. And I think that is something that's different, you know?
So, Noah, you have been a friend to the Hawk Foundation going back to your days at ASH. I still remember, you remember the day that you came in with your peer performers,
Oh my goodness.
Troop.
That was a long time ago. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I will, I think I may include a clip from the video that we did, in the episode, just so that folks have an idea of what it is I'm talking about.
Yeah. The Trauma Alliance. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe you could tell our listeners while we have you exactly what that was. And
that was, you know, it's given me goosebumps here a little bit. That was when I was working at the state hospital.
Yeah.
Our team at that, I mean, that was such a dynamic, incredible group of individuals. And, you know, I was just honored to be a part of that team. It was a process that was led by an incredible peer specialist, Christina Carney. She works at Via Hope. You know, overseeing a lot of the stuff that they do over there. But, you know, something she would talk about all the time, and, well, first and foremost was, you know, trauma or, you know, creating healing-centered environments. But talking about trauma in general was something that needed to come out of the closet. And it was something that needed, you know, it needed to be out in the light of day. People struggled with these types of things all the time. It didn't need to be such a taboo subject. And so she invited our team to take part in this process. And it's really a partnership between her and then another amazing peer specialist, Veronica, that they work together on one of our adult services units. But yeah, so Christina and Veronica came up with this idea to invite the team to kind of go through a process. Everybody was kind of going to go through a creative process of figuring out some sort of way to express themselves or kind of where they were at or what was going on. And then at the end of the process, you know, kind of in creating some kind of a piece, and it could be anything, you know, we met like every week. At the end of it was a presentation or a show. And so the idea was to really unveil and kind of showcase a way to look at creating like a healing-centered environment, and be much more open about that process of looking at the things that go on in your own life. And so we each kind of created a different way of expressing kind of wherever we were at the moment. You know, some of us did movement type stuff. You know, I think Christina had this amazing poem with a cape that was covered with different words. You know, somebody did a painting. It was a really cool thing. And then we showcased it, you know, with individuals and services, really presented with them. And then, you know, a lot of the processes where it engaged folks and services at the hospital where they could then showcase the work they were doing. It was really, you know, very mutual, very participatory, and very cool, like very, very cool. And so the Hogg Foundation got wind of it and made, I think, a video of some of us coming together and doing that presentation.
He's not lying to y'all about the coolness of it. So I just thought I'd give you the chance to plug that or help me plug it a little bit.
Oh man, yeah, that was when stuff was really happening. All right, it was cool.
Well, so Noah, we really do appreciate you taking the time just to fill us in on what's going on at HHSC. We are lucky to have, you know, someone like you on the inside, as it were. Thank you so much, and good luck with everything.
Yeah, take care. Thank you so much.
As you just heard, I couldn't let Noah leave without asking him about one of the cooler things that he did, out of the many cool things that he did while working at Austin State Hospital. And to give you, dear listener, a taste. What you're about to hear is a performing troupe of Austin State Hospital peer support specialists, including Noah, talk about their use of the storytelling showcase as a way to stimulate dialogue around recovery while also dramatizing why those conversations are so challenging in the first place.
That you can say yes to kindness and compassion and love. That you can say yes to living a full life in your body. Your body. My body. I wanted to use the storytelling showcase as a way to start a conversation about healing. It's really hard in the mental health field for people to talk about trauma, and there's not a lot of room for it, so I wanted to create a space where we could have dialogue. There is no nice way to tell you how my body was violated, how I learned that my body was not my own. Anytime you use your voice to speak your truth with the capital T, that is really important in healing.
For 10 years, I withdrew from the world, the final two in virtual isolation. For the past 6 years, I've been able to transform my life. When things get difficult in my life, I'm still pulled to withdraw. The storytelling showcase is a way to really make tangible that recovery is something that's happening for everyone all the time. It's an everyday thing.
We are engaging with people in a very personal and kind of mutual way. So we share who we are and how we got here in the hopes that someone will want to connect with us that way. One of the things I got very interested in is asking people what they saw. And when people started reflecting that back to me, it was really touching.
That you can say no to those who would silence you. That you can say no to anyone who doesn't believe your body is a gift, including yourself. It's like a show and tell, like, oh yes, transformation is not only possible, but I'm gonna show you how I'm doing it and what it looks like.
Engaging with this group of people, they always challenge you to be so honest and transparent about how you're moving through things.
Every time I perform this piece, I experience some healing. To be able to stand in front of people and say, this is what happened, and this is how it's affected me, and this is what I'm doing to make it better, feels really powerful and impactful and important. I know for me, and I think also for the people who hear it as well.
So this is where we are with the consumer movement. As we've seen from all of these examples, consumers have started to come into their own as leaders and visionaries. Continuing with that theme is our next guest. Anna Gray is co-founder of Prosumers International, here to talk with us about her work and provide a different perspective on peer leadership. Anna, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for the opportunity. I really appreciate it.
Okay, so we would like to know all about you. In particular, you know, how did your past experience prepare you for your current role at Prosumers?
Well, so my lived experience, I think, uniquely provided an opportunity for me to fully understand what it is to deal with mental health challenges. I had several incidences when I was younger of just basically not being able to function. And at the time, it was like the adults around me tended to approach it with a, if we ignore it, it'll go away. And so I had a very, and it wasn't like in a bad way, but I had a very tolerant environment that allowed me to go through the emotional challenges that I was dealing with, and not being able to get out of bed and wanting to hole up and not wanting to be around people and creating my own little world to be in. And I think in that sense, I was very fortunate because my experiences were not medicalized early on. And then when so I grew up in Mexico. So I was 19 years old before I came to the United States. And when I came to college, a lot of that familiarity and support and a known environment was no longer available to me. And my freshman year in college was significantly challenging. And I got to the point where I didn't want to be on the planet anymore. And I actually took steps to make sure I wasn't on the planet anymore, and failed miserably. And at the time, my reaction to that is, I can't even do that right. I don't fit in. I don't belong. People don't understand what I'm trying to say. It was a really tough time for me. But again, my way of dealing with all of that was to hide out. I was not identified as having a mental health issue, and I didn't get caught up in the system. The one thing that I did know how to do well was go to school. So I kept doing that. And that landed me in a graduate program in counseling psychology. And I needed a job because graduate school, I couldn't get scholarships or anything to pay for that. So I went to work for a local mental health authority. And in that process, I got to know people who had been in the system, and the impact of having a label and behavior being medicalized and the way in which the world saw people who had a diagnosis. And so the people that I worked with, I actually worked in a halfway house. I spent the weekends with people who were either considered to be in a crisis and working real hard to avoid going to a state hospital, and people who were just getting out of the state hospital and trying to transition back into community. Back then, your average hospitalization was usually 30 days. Many people were in the hospital for 90 days. And so in the process, you would lose everything, lose your apartment, all of your belongings, and a lot of your connections. So it was hard to have that reentry. Anyway, the people I got to spend the weekend with are the people who taught me resilience. And they're the people who taught me, who actually began my recovery. And I say that because here were the people who were experiencing really strong emotions, altered states, altered realities, responding to unseen stimuli. And yet they had dreams, they had hopes, they had concerns about how the situation they were in was going to impact the people they loved. They talked about the people that they had lost contact with, their children that they cared for and wish they could be available to, and how disruptive this whole process had been to their lives. And what I saw was the resiliency of the human spirit, where in the midst of having to deal with some behaviors that were not accepted by their society, and then getting caught up in systems that tended to put them in places they didn't want to be sometimes, and who relegated them to a class of citizenship that was or citizenry that was not accepted by the whole. And, you know, I thought if they could still hold on to hopes and dreams and still fight for having a life, who was I to say that I didn't want to be alive anymore? Who was I to say that our lives do not have value? And that started me down a trajectory of advocacy that hasn't stopped. They gave me my purpose, and I owe them a great deal of debt. And among other things, that landed me working for Advocacy Incorporated, which is now Disability Rights Texas, and I actually got to be an advocate. So I was in and out of state hospitals. I had an opportunity to see what that experience was like and to make a difference for some of the people who were in the hospital. And then I started training peers and started talking about what it would be to have peer support and how us helping each other is really making a difference. And my co-founder of Rosumers, Janet Paleo, was actually one of the very first people hired in that role. She worked for a local mental health authority initially on a volunteer basis because she was so afraid to lose her benefits. Eventually she worked at another local mental health authority and was considered a consumer liaison. And that was what the very first peers began to be called. And through our advocacy and work together, I started training peers and working and developing peer programs. And now I run a peer-run, peer-led, peer-driven organization called Prosumers International.
And I would love to know more about the history of Prosumers. How did it come about?
Well, it's really interesting because Janet and I actually met at a network advisory committee and a planning advisory committee for a local mental health authority. So back in 1996, actually, the state included in the performance contracts that local mental health authorities or local behavioral health authorities would have. We didn't have those back then, but they still are required to have what are called PNACs, planning and network advisory committees. And so we met on a planning and network advisory committee. That's when she was volunteering, and they needed people with lived experience on these committees. And so we got to know each other, and we she was just beginning her journey. And one of the things that she has shared is that she had a mantra. Anytime anything good happened in her life, she would ask herself, was it worth staying alive for this moment? And the answer was always no. And as she was working in this on this committee, and she began to learn more about how the system worked, and at the time I was an advocate, and I was letting her know how it was supposed to work, and she was beginning to see some of the discrepancies and how she could make a difference, about that time her grandson was born. And she had the privilege of being in the delivery room when he was born. And she asked herself, was it worth staying alive for this moment? And the first time in her life, the answer was yes. And in that moment, it hit her that no one should have to wait until they're 42 years old to be glad that they were alive. And that started kind of a mutual development journey for us. She was beginning to find recovery. And I was looking to see how to best advocate and managed to get really highly motivated professionals encouraged in their work. By that time, I had actually been promoted to the South Texas Regional Office of Advocacy Incorporated. And so I was supervising attorneys, and I'm not an attorney. I was supervising licensed professionals, and I'm not a licensed professional. So there was a lot to navigate in terms of how to manage highly trained, highly motivated people and still, you know, do the management piece. So I was looking at all kinds of management material and motivational material that's coming out of business settings and management settings. And Janet was looking at how do I empower people? How do I let people know that life is worth living? And so one day we were talking, and it's like, you know, everything I'm using in management and business is about people thriving and people performing. I'm like, the folks that the LMHA serves are people. And what would it be like if they were performing and thriving in their lives? And out of that grew the prosumer group. We started having monthly groups in which we discussed what it would look like to have amazing lives and what were the skills that we needed to live a powerful and amazing life. And it wasn't about a diagnosis, and it wasn't about, you know, the challenges or the troublesome behaviors. It was about daring to dream again. So that's kind of how it developed and grew. And today what we do is we dare people to dream again. And then once they start daring to dream, we challenge them to take action to have those dreams come true. So it's all about how do we thrive in life? Because in the process of the passion for thriving, because living life is intentional. When we start living life intentionally, moving towards thriving, all those things that hold us back have to get taken care of. So now I have a whole different approach or a whole different reason to, you know, deal with those behaviors that may be holding me back, and finding what works for me to be able to deal with them in a way that gets me what I want. So it's a whole different approach to living life and to these things we call mental health issues.
So I did have you listen to part of my interview with Noah Abdenor from our last segment. Mm-hmm. What do you think about his challenges at HHSC, and what are you hoping that he's able to achieve?
Well, so we are very fortunate to have Noah in that position. I think he is uniquely qualified, given his background in both state hospital setting and a local mental health authority. And he has done a remarkable job, and his team, he's put together a remarkable team as well. So I definitely get the challenges that he's facing. I agree with him. One of the biggest challenges we have in our field today is developing administrators, is pivoting from doing the direct care to how do we build the infrastructure that promotes peers and promotes the development of peer leaders. And that has been a big challenge for us. So his listing that as one of his challenges when he started working for HHSC is right on point. It's, you know, we our lived experience uniquely qualifies us, and it's well earned. It's better than any graduate program, but it doesn't prepare us for management or administration. And it doesn't always give us the tools to view the world in a perspective of growing a profession, which is what we're doing. And so that's absolutely one of the biggest challenges. The other thing that I thought of as I was listening to him, we are extremely fortunate in having Executive Deputy Commissioner Sonia Gaines in the position she's in, and her dedication to all things that will affect and improve the lives of people with mental health issues, with intellectual and developmental disabilities. Her leadership has been instrumental in us even being where we are. And she has put together an amazing team with Deputy Commissioner Trina Ida and also others that are in positions to actually make a difference, who really get what it is to provide those direct services. When I say we're challenged, it's that we have people who get it. And when leadership changes, then all of the work that we tend to have done sometimes gets lost. So we're at a very, very special point in our development of our profession, in that we do have champions. And I think it's important for us to take advantage of all of what they're offering, so that we can begin to develop our profession, so to the point where we are able to do true mental health recovery and not be co-opted, to put it frankly.
What do you consider the most rewarding aspect of your work?
Those moments when I get discouraged, one of the prosumers will call and just spontaneously say how their life has changed because they have had an opportunity to come to the prosumer groups. Or they will, so we've had several prosumers who have actually bought their own home, and they never thought that was going to be possible. We have prosumers who have completed college education, and they knew for a fact that was never going to happen. We have a couple of the prosumers who've started their own nonprofits. Just last month, Janet wrote an article around how expectations will, it's our expectations that cause us upset. It's not necessarily what other people are doing, because when we expect something and it doesn't happen, then we're the ones that get upset. And how maybe managing our expectations can be a good way to help manage our life. And she must have gotten 3 or 4 different calls about the impact that that article made on them from the Prosumer News. In the meetings, now that we're doing the meetings by Zoom, people will put in the chat, "This is just what I needed to hear today." People going back and getting their GEDs, and just being able to dream of things that they never thought possible. And it's just such a humbling experience to see what people go on to do when we first encounter them. They are being a good patient. They have a diagnosis. They're managing their symptoms. They're, it's all about whether or not they're taking their medication. And they get to choose how big they want to dream. But we find people move along that continuum towards feeling valued, getting that what they have to offer matters, even if it may be just a smile. And that we all have something to offer. We all have value. It's hard to put into words the expressions of gratitude that people have shown, and what they're doing is telling us about their power, their resiliency, and their strength. That's what this is about. And if we had a system that saw that as the expected outcome of treatment, what a different world we would live in.
Okay, so you are in San Antonio. For those who are nearby, how can they, you know, find out a little bit more about prosumers and maybe get involved?
So we actually have groups in North Texas, in Plano. We have groups in Houston, and we have a group in McAllen, and then we have the group in San Antonio. So we're kind of all over the state. And to get involved, you can go to our website. It's theprosumers.org. So that's theprosumers.org. And there's all kinds of resources there. We also have internet-based radio. And the radio station is actually a recovery tool. All of the songs that are on the radio station have powerful I statements. I can, I overcame, I'll make it through. And just listening to it elevates your mood. But in terms of contacting us, please feel free. There's a way of contacting us on the website. When you send an email, it goes directly to Janet. She does read them. You can call us at our 800 number. And our 800 number is 800-577-3795. So that's 800-577-3795. And you can just reach out and join any of our groups. We have various groups that we have. We have our prosumer meeting, which is the monthly meetings we started with in all four of those areas. But we also have other groups throughout the week that you're more than welcome to join. You can get in touch with us through any of our groups as well.
Anna Gray of Prosumers, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. You know, among all the things we talk about, we still feel that it's really important to give our listeners a full-bodied sense of everything that consumers are doing around Texas and all the different pressure points to making, you know, meaningful change, you know, that consumers can impact. And so thank you so much.
I really appreciate it. Thank you for the opportunity.
Before signing off, I would like to return to episode 77, which you heard a bit of at the start of this episode. I can't pass up this opportunity for us to hear one more time our dear departed friend Stephanie Bryan encapsulating her own journey as consumer and family liaison for the Hogg Foundation. She's going to be taking us home. If you have comments on anything, or there's anything you would like to share about the podcast, feel free to reach out to us at intothefold@austin.utexas.edu. Great comments will be acknowledged during an upcoming episode, just as taking care of ourselves enhances our ability to help others, so it is as well that by helping others, we enhance our own resilience. Production assistants Veronica Rodriguez and Anna Harris, thanks as always to the Hogg Foundation for its wonderful support. Leave us a review, subscribe to us on the podcast app of your choice. You can find us on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, TuneIn, and Stitcher. And now, Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
In discussions related to our work, I noticed that some of my colleagues showed discomfort when I brought up concepts and topics such as stigma and discrimination, diversity and equity and inclusion, or systematic oppression. And all of this came from my lens as a consumer. It wasn't my lens as, it wasn't my view as a philanthropist, as a clinician, as anybody that had ever worked in a foundation and had that historical, I'll call it baggage. How about that? That, you know, I don't think that those conversations were prominent at the time that I was hired. I will say that I think today the foundation is sizzling, absolutely sizzling with sensitive topics. I think there are still hard conversations to have, but we are having discussions about racial biases, about gender discrimination, political issues. We even talk about our own perceived power and privilege as members of the philanthropic sector. We are having discussions about power and privilege within our own organization. And we will continue to have courageous conversations, I think, to help us learn our way to solutions together.